Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we revive weird and wonderful science unarchived directly into your ears. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this second Blast from the Past edition, this week is more gems from 2003. First up, here's news about baby teeth. In 2003, Chris Stewart reported,
"Well, baby teeth may be worth much more than the small change under the pillow. Scientists at the US Department of Health and Human Services have found that the first set of teeth we shed as children may be a good source of adult stem cells. Unlike all other cells in the body, stem cells have the potential to grow into any kind of tissue. Grown in the laboratory, they could be used for a wide range of medical treatments, including the growth of artificial organs. But stem cell research is surrounded by controversy because the cells are typically taken from an unborn fetus. The US scientists are currently examining whether baby teeth are a reliable source for harvesting these cells. The discovery that every child grows and voluntarily parts with 20 stem cell factories in their baby teeth could be a major boost for the supporters of therapeutic stem cell research."
Fast forward to the current day, and we're now starting to use these stem cells. Nearly half of all kids suffer some kind of injury to a tooth during childhood. And if that happens while their permanent teeth are still growing, the blood supply and root development of the growing teeth can be affected, sometimes leaving a dead tooth that doesn't feel anything. In 2018, researchers used stem cells from children's own baby teeth to repair the soft pulp in the centre of their damaged teeth. The human deciduous pulp stem cell treatment returned feelings of hot and cold to the repaired teeth. This treatment makes sure the tooth stays alive. The results of the clinical trial showed that the injured teeth of the children who'd been given human deciduous pulp stem cells from baby teeth had increased blood flow and thicker dentin, as well as signs of healthy root development. A year afterwards, only those on the new treatment had regained some sensation in their damaged teeth. Kids being kids, one of the children in the trial unfortunately re-injured the healed tooth and had to have it extracted. This gave the researchers a chance to examine the tooth after it had been successfully treated. They found the stem cells had regenerated dentin-producing cells, connective tissue, and blood vessels, which all help to make up dental pulp. For adults, researchers either have to find out how stem cells from other people's baby teeth react in a foreign body, or find drugs that stimulate stem cells in adult teeth. In 2017, researchers identified a drug called Tideglucib that can activate stem cells inside a tooth's pulpy center and potentially regrow some of that tissue inside. No human trials have been carried out yet, but work is ongoing. The paper on the baby teeth stem cells was titled "Deciduous Autologous Tooth Stem Cells Regenerate Dental Pulp After Implantation into Injured Teeth," and was published in the journal Science Translational Medicine. You're listening to Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. From August 2003, here's Amanda Hamilton speaking with Professor Malcolm Simons about his patent of the junk DNA that makes up 95% of our genetic inheritance.
You've probably all heard of a molecule called DNA.
The role of DNA is to code for building proteins. Only 5% of the DNA was found to do that. The remaining 95% didn't seem to do anything, so it was called junk. Now it seems that the junk is not junk after all, and it was an Australian microbiologist who saw the value in this junk DNA. In fact, he went so far as to patent 95% of the DNA of all living creatures on our planet. It was an act of extraordinary and provocative foresight. Researchers are confirming that non-coding DNA holds critical clues to a vast range of diseases, such as breast cancer, HIV, heart disease, Alzheimer's, ovarian and skin cancer. The list is growing daily. A leading figure in world genetics, Professor John Mattick, recently claimed that the failure to recognize the implications of the non-coding DNA will go down as the biggest mistake in the history of molecular biology. Dr. Malcolm Simons has turned junk into gold, inflaming one of the greatest controversies of our time, the control and ownership of our genetic material. I spoke to Dr. Simons to find out more about how this patent came about.
Well, the idea was that genes are what matter because they code for proteins. And anything that doesn't code for a protein isn't worth knowing about. And the diseases that we knew about involved errors, mutations in coding region genes. So the focus was on genes. And even though it was known that they represent a very small proportion of the total genetic material, the total genome, 5% is the number commonly quoted, basically people breathed a sigh of relief that it was only 1/20th of the genome they had to know anything about. And the rest of it was not even barely given a name, and so it was just thought to be junk. And in the 80s, we didn't have the ability, as we have now, to analyze the DNA at a sequence level, and so there were indirect ways of looking at genes. And although those markers were in the junk region, people's mindset was, what do they tell us about the genes? For example, there's a blood disorder that your audience may have heard the name of, thalassemia, a red cell disorder. Well, everybody was looking at the gene that underlies the hemoglobin, that is the blood pigment inside red cells that is defective and leads to the clinical disease. So everybody wanted to know about the globin gene. They were using techniques which actually used markers around the gene more often than in it, but the mindset was, let's just concentrate on coding region genes. And when I came along, we had particular genes to look at. Your audience probably knows about ABO blood groups. They may have heard about HLA, that's the genes that are involved in tissue typing that you need to test and type for when you're matching for a donor for a transplant recipient. And we were looking at those HLA genes. There are many, many, many more of them. They're much more complicated than any other region in the whole of the genome. And we were still looking at the genes, but the data was coming out of the non-coding region. So I had a chance to look at whether or not the non-coding regions were junk. Not that we were focused on the non-coding regions, just that the technique worked in the non-coding regions, and it occurred to me, lo and behold, the patterns we were seeing were not junk. They were not disordered. They were not chaotic. They were, in fact, highly non-random and highly organized. And that led me to think that, well, whatever's going on in the non-coding region, junk it certainly wasn't.
And that led you to decide to take a patent out on this junk DNA?
No, that was a scientific process where I was living in the United States. This research was done in Salt Lake City. I was living in the Bay Area, the new technology that all the younger geneticists know as polymerase chain reaction, PCR, to be able to grow one copy of a gene into a haystack of those copies, was just coming in. So I knew about both worlds, and I was basically commuting between both worlds. And so it seemed to me that if the so-called junk region wasn't junk, maybe you could use this new technique involving sequence amplification to capture all this ordered, non-random information. So it was an idea first, and I put it back into my intellectual repository company in Hong Kong, and then eventually that company looked for an investor, transferred that intellectual property into that company, and then sought to protect it by initiating a patent process, by putting it in written form and filing it with a patent office as an application for patent. That's what happened.
It's been reported that this patent applies to 95% of the DNA of most living creatures. That's what we're reading in newspapers and things like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's correct.
Is that absolutely?
The patent that was issued in 1997 refers to the use of the sequence information content in non-coding regions, as it provides information about coding region genes and combinations of genes in all species.
Already, there are over 2,000 worldwide infringements on the patent, which is held by a Melbourne-based company, Genetic Technologies. These companies are outraged and refuse to take the patent seriously. However, this week, the University of Sydney was the first academic institution to pay money to Genetic Technologies. These issues are not going to go away. They raise questions about whether or not it is fair enough for a researcher to patent his or her work and protect its outcome. Or, on the other hand, how much control do we want researchers or corporations to have over our genes?
It is indeed a brave new world. That was Amanda Hamilton talking with Dr. Malcolm Simons.
Next up from September 2003 is Tim Baines talking about the impact of extreme weather on human history.
Who among us has not planned some outdoor event only to be foiled at the last by inclement weather? Rain, wind, fog. But spare a thought for those poor folk who get caught in the extreme weather, ice storms, cyclones, and sudden cold snaps. Some extreme weather actually makes history, like Cyclone Tracy hitting Darwin on Christmas Eve 1974, or the Maunder Minimum freezing Europe in 1695. And then there's weather that interacts with history, like the unfavourable winds that turned back the Spanish Armada within sight of the English shoreline, and who can forget that old classic of invading Russia in winter, as Hitler did. On more than one occasion, there has been an uncanny coincidence of extreme weather and a crucial moment in history. I'm going to give you just two or three examples. The first is from the 14th of August, 1281, when the incredibly vast Mongolian Empire set its sights on acquiring the islands of Japan. Kublai Khan, son of Genghis Khan, had twice before been beaten back from invading because he underestimated the fanatical resilience of the Japanese. But on this third occasion, he planned to overwhelm them with a truly enormous military force, even by today's standards. In sheer numbers, it remains the biggest armada that has ever sailed. Pretty much anything that floated along the east coast of China was commandeered for the invasion. Some 3,500 vessels carrying hundreds of thousands of men, most of whom had spent their entire lives on land. On the Japanese side, the samurai had been steadily depleted in numbers and equipment from the previous attacks, and although they were brave and resolute, there wasn't much hope. It was time for the brown underwear. The Mongol forces planned to come ashore at a small circular inlet known as Hakusaki Bay, but the night before the planned assault, there were very rough seas. Anyone with maritime experience could tell there was a big storm on the way, but most of the Mongol generals in charge had no such experience, and instead of staying put, they planned to sail the next day. The timing couldn't have been worse. At the exact moment that all the Mongol vessels were huddled in them, in a bay ready to attack, nature attacked them. A monsoon struck. The force of the winds and the size of the swell meant that the boats were uncontrollable, and they crashed into each other and the rocky shore. The bay was turned into a mash of broken wood and bodies. Without a single Mongol soldier setting foot on Japanese soil, the armada was defeated, and in 48 hours, it's estimated 100,000 men died mostly from drowning. The Japanese Buddhist priests declared that this event must surely be a sign from heaven that their country is indeed divinely gifted, and they gave thanks for what they called the kamikaze, which actually means divine wind. Now fast forward 530 years to Napoleon's ill-fated Russian campaign. Napoleon was quite bumptious about how easily he would defeat Alexander I. He would take some 430,000 men and over 1,000 cannons and head straight to Moscow. Go in the spring and it would be all over before the leaves fell from the trees. The idea was clearly a quick decapitation of the Russian power hierarchy, but Napoleon overrated himself in a couple of important respects. Firstly, Russia is huge. Even now, after you exclude all the independent states, the land area of Russia is more than twice that of Australia. Perhaps because of the scale of the task, Napoleon's campaign took longer than expected. Secondly, this vast army had come unprepared with the clothing for the winter, and the coats that Napoleon's troops were eventually given had a small but vital defect. To cut costs, the French army had made buttons on their winter coats out of tin. No big deal normally, but in the extreme cold of the Russian winter, where it can get below minus 30, that tin becomes very brittle indeed. In fact, it crumbles, falls off. Not a button anymore. Now, this might not have been the crucial factor in Napoleon's defeat, but consider the problem of close-up combat when your coat is flapping open to the icy wind and you have to use one arm to keep it wrapped and then fight off Russians. Just for the record, the Russians did actually start a war of their own with Finland that was conducted entirely in one winter between November 1939 and March 1940. It's appropriately called the Winter War, in which Finland was ultimately invaded, though not because of the weather. There were simply more Russians than Finns. And finally, I have a personal experience with extreme weather. A bit over 4 years ago, I remember I was moving house. Now that can be an ordeal in itself, but unbeknownst to me, I had chosen the worst, the most disastrous possible time to move anything in Sydney for perhaps 50 years. It had been an unseasonably warm April afternoon and some fairly serious storm clouds were brewing on the southern horizon, but I wasn't too worried. After all, I owned very little and pretty much all of it could be moved in one go, strapped to the back of a ute. No worries. Little did I realize that within half an hour, Sydney would experience the worst hailstorm it had seen for three generations, possibly the most intense thunderstorm on record. I won't easily forget the feeling of being completely powerless as I watched literally everything I owned being pelted from a great height by golf ball-sized chunks of ice. And I was lucky. Many more people were worse off than me. So if you want advice, I say don't make your winter coat buttons out of tin, don't invade Russia in winter, and if you have to invade Japan or just move house, choose a cool, dry, clear day when thunderstorms are unlikely. Unless, of course, you, like me, want a fridge with hail damage.
That was Tim Baines talking about extreme weather in history.
And finally, here I am from August 2003 talking about aphasia. It took me 6 months to write this story because I was suffering from aphasia.
Imagine you're a chatty, eloquent person, used to clever quips and puns. Suddenly you find you can't remember the word for that long pointy thing that you mark paper with. Ian Wolfe looks into the thing called aphasia.
You have aphasia when your brain has problems with expressing and understanding language. It can affect a person's control of the muscles in their throat, mouth, and hands. It can also affect their ability to translate thoughts into words and words back into thoughts. The parts of the brain that translate language are physically near the sensory motor areas for the mouth and throat, so it's not a total surprise that a problem that hits one brain function may also affect the brain modules nearby. Aphasia can develop after someone suffers a stroke, where a blood clot stops oxygen getting to your brain, basilar, arterial, migraine. Bad whack to the head, brain cancer, or brain swelling caused by infection or a poison from contaminated food. So aphasia can be chronic and require treatment, or it can be transient and clear up in a few hours or days. Infection, or poisons causing swelling in the brain, is called encephalitis. It can come and go, depending on how well the body is fighting the foreign proteins. This happened to me. After getting my head read by magnetic resonance imaging, doing the rounds of neurologists, psychiatrists, and gastroenterologists, I was diagnosed with recurring, transient, mild aphasia, caused by overstimulation of the brain by some unknown foreign protein. Maybe something I ate. Aphasia can be so severe as to make communication almost impossible, or it can be very mild. It may affect mainly a single aspect of language skills, such as being able to retrieve the names of things, or the ability to put words together into sentences, or even the ability to read. People may have trouble mainly in understanding what they hear or read, or just in speaking or writing, or both. People with mild aphasia may have trouble understanding language only when it's long or complex, or they may have some trouble finding the words they need to express an idea or to explain themselves. Problems with finding words are called anomia and are common in people with aphasia. It's kind of like having a word on the tip of your tongue, but not being able to remember it all the time. They might not be able to access the word comb, even though they can show you how to use it. Or they can describe it as that thing you use on your hair to make it tidy. It requires extra effort for people with aphasia to understand spoken messages, as if they're trying to understand a foreign language. They may need extra time to process and understand what's being said, sort of like the time lag on round-the-world satellite interviews on TV. Mild aphasia can also give problems with understanding even mild foreign accent differences, like that between Canadian and Australian English. It can make people slur their words or even invent new ones. It can make your voice change from baritone to tenor. The more distractions in the room, the harder it can be for some suffering aphasia to process mentally all of the concepts in a conversation. People with mild aphasia can miss the subtleties of language. They can become over-literal and misunderstand when someone intends a joke with wordplay. People will naturally assume that you don't find the joke funny when you actually had a double take, first to translate the literal meaning and then later to understand the wordplay. Difficulty with some of these skills can lead to communication breakdowns and frustrating communication for both the person with aphasia and the people they're talking with. When the aphasia is mild, it can appear that you just aren't paying attention or even that you're willfully misunderstanding what someone is really trying to say to you. Even mild aphasia can be devastating to career and relationships. A phone conversation where the spoken word is the only means of communication can be too hard, and so people with aphasia start to avoid the phone. So what can be done about it? For a start, if you or someone you know suffer from mild aphasia, then conversations are easier if you can be face-to-face with someone, so that body language and facial expression can be part of the communication. Turn off the music or the TV and move away from crowded areas, so that the aphasic person has as little environmental noise competing for their brain space as possible. If the conversation slows down a little, then the aphasic person has time to process what you're saying and appreciate it, and also to find the right words for what they want to say. The main treatment available is speech therapy. A speech therapist can help you to train your brain to relearn the language skills and bypass the brain damage. Mostly, this is teaching you different ways to use your voice, lips, tongue, and hands. There are also exercises to practice in composing thoughts into sentences and using a wider range of words with speech, phone, and writing exercises. Depending on the cause of the aphasia, there may also be a need for retraining of manual skills to address fine motor control of your hands. If you haven't had an obvious life-threatening event like a stroke or head injury, and you can still speak sometimes, it can be very hard to get diagnosed correctly and to be believed that you're having a problem. After all, the doctor is relying on your ability to communicate clearly in order to understand that you can't communicate clearly. It's very easy for a doctor who doesn't know you to miss that you're communicating in a very different way to how you did before. It's key to have a doctor who knows you well in order to recognise that you aren't well. Aphasia is not just caused by visible damage like injury and stroke. It can also be caused by more subtle damage caused by infection or poisons. Aphasia isn't just about not being able to speak. It defines a wide spectrum of language problems from complete speechlessness through to missing the punchline. Or at least getting it later than you did before. This week from 2003, you heard the voices of Chris Stewart, Amanda Hamilton, Tim Baines, and me. Next week, a new interview with Sam Bladwell about Spintronics and new news. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolfe. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station, 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons on patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.